The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to The Beat. I'm Alicia Menendez, in for Ari Melber. We start tonight with Donald Trump siding with January 6th rioters ahead of massive security preps for this Saturday's new right-wing rally. D.C. law enforcement taking no chances. New fencing is up outside the Capitol. Workers installing it overnight in preparation for this Saturday's so-called Justice for J6 rally. The event in support of the rioters charged with crimes for the deadly January 6th insurrection. And today, former President Trump out with a statement expressing sympathy for them. Quote, our hearts and minds are with the people being persecuted so unfairly relating to the January 6th protests concerning the rigged presidential election. Now, just to state the obvious, the election was not rigged. Trump lost. January 6th. Not a protest, it was an insurrection, an attack on our democracy. These rioters have been charged with felonies ranging from assault to conspiracy to attacks on police officers. Many have already pled guilty. Speaker Pelosi saying that this time, D.C. will be ready.
January 6th was for us one of the worst days in our country's history. They're going to come Saturday again. They have their plans to come. Everybody will be ready. More ready for them.
This rally is being organized by a former Trump campaign official, but new reports reveal that some far-right extremists are urging people not to attend because they think, somehow, that it is actually a secret government plot to arrest more people involved in the January 6th riot. You cannot make it up. But officials aren't just worried about D.C. Dozens of local J6 rallies are planned around the country without the security resources of the federal government to help keep people safe. Joining me now, former federal prosecutor Joyce Vance, Washington editor for Aussie Media, Katty Kay, and former assistant director for counterintelligence at the FBI, Frank Figluzzi. Frank, I want to start with you. Tell us what you expect to see this Saturday.
First, I expect to see extraordinary, even unprecedented, security precautions. I expect to see intelligence sharing and collection and a posture across the Capital Region that brings in all departments. And that's all what we're seeing right now. That's the good news. I also expect to and will watch carefully for three things. Attendance. The numbers count. How many people are going to show up? How many people are fed up with the lie, the conspiracy, and will not throw their support behind the January 6th rioters? Will there be a presence of violent domestic terror organizations in large numbers? I think not. I'm not expecting to see that based on the chatter I see on their sites. And then lastly, who's going to take the podium? What's the radicalizing rhetoric we're going to hear about January 6th and the rioters? And is that going to include more mainstream elected officials, government officials, Trump advisors, or are we going to see a distancing from that podium and a lack of attendance, all pointing to very good signs ahead if that's the case?
Well, Katty, to Frank's last point there, we know that no GOP members of Congress are currently planning to attend that rally. If that sticks, what does that say to you?
I think it shows you how much the Republican members up on Capitol Hill are kind of caught between President Trump himself with his statement today in support of the protesters effectively, and a base that really does believe that the January 6th rioters were righteous, justified, good people, and the desire they have to get as far away from this as possible. Republicans understand that when they are talking about January the 6th, that's not a winning strategy for them electorally. They want to keep the focus on Joe Biden. So it doesn't surprise me that members, even Marjorie Greene, are not saying that they're going to be there in attendance this weekend.
Joyce, it pains me to have to read that statement from the former president. How dangerous is it for Trump to frame the rioters as, quote, protesters, given the crimes that they are accused of?
Fortunately, the former president's megaphone speaks a little bit less loudly than it did when he still had access to social media platforms. But even though social media has taken steps to lessen his voice, that doesn't make these sort of comments any less dangerous. And we know he continues to deliberately mislead Americans for his own purposes. That in and of itself should be an indicia of unfitness. That should be something that the Republican Party is running away from, not continuing to embrace. This notion that a president, a former president, one who wants to be perhaps the future president, would lie to people in an effort to prop himself up, it seems to be out of bounds. And yet in 2021, it isn't.
Well, Katie, the New York Times is reporting that Trump views the planned protests on Saturday as a setup that the news media will use against him regardless of the outcome. Katie, that seems like a great way to take no responsibility regardless of what the outcome is.
Yeah, or point to the fact that he's going golfing in New Jersey at Bedminster this weekend instead of being anywhere near this rally that's taking place here in Capitol Hill, and then is flying back down to Mar-a-Lago. There's also chatter online, and I'm sure Frank has seen this too, that you've got some of the groups that might be attending, and this might be why I think Frank is right, that the numbers may not be nearly as big, clearly, as the thousands, tens of thousands who are here on January the 6th, but might not be as big as might even be anticipated. This group that's organizing this Look Ahead America has had a track record of saying that they were going to have much bigger numbers than they actually ended up having. And then with President Trump saying, look, this could be a setup, and some of the groups who might normally attend this also saying on online chatter and social media platforms, look, be careful, this is a setup, they're just bringing you to Washington in order to make further arrests. It sort of gives people a bit of an out if they're nervous about coming or perhaps, you know, want to avoid the spectacle of any kind of violence here in Washington on Saturday.
Frank, your thoughts on what Katie just laid out?
Yeah, look, there's a good sign here that 600 arrests, 60 guilty pleas so far, is having a chilling effect on violent planning and action. And that's a good thing. The chatter says what I'm seeing is I don't want to get arrested. They're going to arrest all of us. Don't go. Now, here's the flip side of this. There are plans for rallies, very similar rallies, even from the same organizers, around the United States. Yes. In smaller places, smaller cities, that could challenge law enforcement. That's something to watch Saturday and the following weekend, September 25th.
So, Frank, if you are local law enforcement and you are watching this chatter and see that there might actually be a bubbling up in your city, what type of preparations are you taking now?
You want to partner with the feds on this. You want the force multiplier of a joint terrorism task force, FBI, DHS, and others telling you, here's what we're seeing globally, nationally, that can help you do that. Then you want to start preparing. It might be a budget increase for overtime. It's shift work. Get your intel. Your source is going. Send a message. You're not going to let it happen here. You're going to have designated protest areas. You're going to separate counter protesters from, say, Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, 3%ers. You got to get your act in gear. It is going to go local Saturday or the next weekend. And that seems to be the model for the foreseeable future.
Frank, there's new reporting out today about the Department of Homeland Security, which warned law enforcement agencies this spring that domestic extremists had used TikTok in the lead up to the January 6th riots on the Capitol, including by promoting bringing guns to Washington that day. Frank, my TikTok feed, hacks for making my kids lunch, hacks for cleaning my shower. So the algorithm missing me. But how dangerous is the fact that none of these social platforms seem to have a handle on how to stop extremists from using their platforms for recruitment?
We need to listen to the CEOs of these very platforms when they tell us, and they are, they can't do this alone. They need help. When a CEO of one of these platforms tells us they need congressional regulation, we better listen. And I've been an advocate for increased regulation. They need to be treated more like a public utility. We need to start rating and reviewing those that get it right, try to get it right. Facebook alone has 20 to 30,000 employees who come to work every day under the rubric of safety and security, and that's still not enough. It's not within their control. We need government regulation. We need smarter consumerism when it comes to our social media.
Joyce, I do want to turn to these sham election audits. Quote, a Republican-led committee in Pennsylvania voted to advance a subpoena of private information of millions of the state's voters as part of a partisan Arizona-style inquiry into the 2020 election. This is related to our discussion because it's the direct effect of the big lie, misinformation rampant in right-wing circles. What do you make of this, that these so-called election audits are, we're in September, they're still happening?
I think that they're better called fraudits, right, Alicia? Because these are not true audits of elections. I mean, unfortunately, it's not my label, but I think it gets it perfectly. These arguably violate federal law. Earlier this year, there was a letter sent out by DOJ's Civil Rights Division to Arizona saying, you know, we're watching laws that require proper tracking of election materials, of ballots and of machines after the fact. So there's the possibility of action from DOJ if this continues on. But the real impact is local, because elections are run on local budget dollars in large part. And so when you have one of these fraudits, then the machines become compromised. We're seeing situations where counties in some states are actually having to acquire new equipment because their old equipment is tainted. So the spillover here is more than just the perpetuation of the big lie, which this, make no mistake about it, explicitly is by state legislatures that have been increasingly prone to adopt anti-voter measures. But also, it has a real impact in terms of administration of future elections and how that funding spills out. All of this means that the only real answer here is for the Senate to bypass the filibuster and adopt both the John Lewis Voting Rights Act and the new the compromise bill that would carry forward the For the People Act from the House. Without those measures, our elections will be in disarray.
Joyce, I got to say that faudits makes a lot more sense than what I do, which is to try to put air quotes, and I can never figure out whether or not the camera can see me when I put them around the word audits here. Katie, I want to play some sound from Speaker Pelosi, and I'm going to get your take on the other side. Take a listen.
Just this weekend, all of us were assembled with three of our presidents in New York on 9/11. That was an assault from outside. It was horrible, and again, unless you want me to, I won't go into some of the details of that. That was horrible. But having an assault from within our country was, no one could have ever, this is just between us, you won't tell anybody I said this. No one could have ever expected that the President of the United States would incite an insurrection.
Kelly, she draws that connection between an assault from the outside and assault from within. Is there really any difference?
Look, we heard the former President George Bush address exactly that point in his remarks, in his very powerful remarks in Pennsylvania on the anniversary, where he talked about the fact that America was now at risk of being attacked from inside as much as it was more than it is almost from outside. And he said, look, these people are very culturally different. They have different religions. They come from different backgrounds, but their purpose is the same. And the danger they pose to the United States is the same. You just have to look back at the last 20 years and see the number of people that have died at the hands of domestic terrorists is far higher in the United States than it is from outside terrorists. The numbers show us that. And I think, you know, both Speaker Pelosi and President Bush are pointing to something that is increasingly being recognized in this country by law enforcement as well as by the general public.
All right, Katty, Frank, thank you both so much. Joyce, you are staying with me because I want to turn now to another breaking news story. A grand jury indicting a prominent cybersecurity lawyer, Michael Sussman, as part of a special counsel's probe into the origins of the Trump-Russia investigation, alleging he made false statements to the FBI during the 2016 presidential campaign. Sussman's firm has deep Democratic ties, including representing Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. The false statement was allegedly made during a meeting 5 years ago about Trump and Russia. The deadline to bring charges was coming up this weekend. Sussman denies wrongdoing. Joyce, what do you make of this indictment?
So we're seeing this indictment for the first time this afternoon. There may be more evidence to come, but based on this indictment, it looks pretty thin, Alicia. The core of this crime that's charged, it's 18 U.S. Code 1001, making a false statement to a government official. This was the same charge that was made against Mike Flynn for his conversations with the Russian ambassador, the charges that were ultimately dismissed by Bill Barr after Flynn had pleaded guilty not once but twice. place. And that offense requires the government to prove that the defendant made a material misstatement of fact, made a material lie to folks who were conducting a federal investigation. Material means that it has to be something important that could influence the outcome of that proceeding. So the allegation here looks a little bit thin. It was well known to folks that Sussman's firm represented the DNC and did work for the Clinton campaign. But beyond that, when the FBI decides to open an investigation, they do that when they're presented with credible information that something has arisen that requires investigation. The source of that information isn't particularly important to them. And so in this case, it seems likely that whether or not the FBI's general counsel was aware that Sussman was working for the Clinton campaign, which, by the way, there's some conflicting information about whether he was working for them when he entered that meeting. It appears he was not. But the real point here is whether there would have been an investigation anyhow. It seems likely there would have been. This is a tough case for DOJ.
All right, Joyce Vance, as always, thank you. Coming up, how Trump's former aides are spending millions of dollars to try to block Biden's domestic agenda. We're going to talk live to Democratic Senator Chris Murphy. Plus, new reporting on how Mark Zuckerberg ignored Facebook's own research on how their site was fueling anger and outrage. And a fact check on Fox News claims about the COVID vaccine mandate. Stay with us.
You can live out your MasterChef dreams when you find a professional on Angie to tackle your dream kitchen remodel. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
MAGA world is getting nervous about Biden's plan to expand the safety net while taxing the rich. And here is how you know. New reporting on a band of former Trump aides cooking up a plot to fight Biden's proposal. A planned $10 million PR blitz led by some in Trump's inner circle, including his economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, and Trump ally, Stephen Moore, the very champions of the tax cuts for the rich that Democrats are now trying to roll back. Biden today making that contrast very clear.
They're attacking me and my plan, which is fine. But if you're going to have a debate, let's have an honest debate. My Republican friends are attacking my plan, saying it's big spending. Let me remind you, these are the same folks who just 4 years ago passed the Trump tax cut, totaling almost $2 trillion in tax cuts.
Under Speaker Pelosi, all House committees now finished with their work on the spending bill. It includes major Democratic priorities, extending the child tax credit, expanding Medicare, and universal paid family leave. There are still debates over prescription drug prices and questions over whether senators like Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema will back $3.5 trillion in spending. Biden meeting with both those senators this week. Big picture, Biden's agenda getting a big new thumbs up from 15 Nobel Prize winning economists, writing that the plan is necessary for America's economic success. The Nobel winners aligned with the majority of Americans who also back Biden's plan, which may be why MAGA world is so nervous. I'm going to talk to a top Democrat on the front lines of this fight when we're back in just 60 seconds. Joining me now, Democratic Senator from Connecticut, Chris Murphy, member of the Senate Appropriations Committee. Senator, MAGA world trying to torpedo Biden's plan. Your response. What do you think is motivating them?
Well, it's not surprising. I mean, what Biden's plan is seeking to do is to, you know, take power from corporations and billionaires and millionaires and deliver it to middle America, to middle class families and poor families who have been struggling to make ends meet. That means that corporations are going to pay more taxes. That means that billionaires are going to have to pay their fair share. That means that the pharmaceutical companies aren't going to make $2 billion in profits next year. So, of course, the MAGA crowd, which has been funded by those billionaire and corporate interests for a while, are going to be busy trying to undermine this agenda. But we've seen it before. I just think that the American people are on our side here. They want to see us deliver for them. They are sick and tired of those elites getting everything they ask for and want from Washington. And while it'll be a fight, it's a fight worth having.
Of course, there are a lot of eyes on Senator Manchin, Senator Sinema. Have you spoken with either of them, with both of them? What specifically do they need in order to get on board?
Well, listen, I guess I do agree with Senator Manchin when he says we shouldn't be guided by some arbitrary number. And we spent a lot of time talking about, you know, whether the overall size of this package should be 3.5 trillion or 6 trillion or 1 trillion. Let's just decide what the American people need in order to survive. And I think we can find consensus if we sort of build the agenda from the bottom up. And so I think we can find consensus on universal pre-K. I think we can find consensus on expanding Medicare benefits for seniors. In the end, if we sort of look at it through that lens and not be wedded to, you know, one number that we're reaching for, I think we can ultimately get the support of 50 Democrats.
But what is it then that you think you cannot find consensus on?
I mean, again, I have not had detailed negotiations with those senators to know which parts of the agenda that they might not be willing to support. I named a few that I think we can find consensus on. Of course, you know, for me, the elements of this bill which attack climate change are most important. And I guess what worries me is listening to Senator Manchin in particular express reservations about the pieces of this agenda that are going to save our climate and our planet from death and destruction. So that part is maybe the hardest to find consensus on, but in some ways it's the most important. So we had conversations this week between all 50 of us. Senator Manchin was in the room trying to find that common ground on the social spending and the climate provisions. And I still have faith that we'll get there.
Okay, Senator Murphy, three House Dems voted against lower drug prices. How important is it to get this specific piece right?
So this is just absolutely crazy that we allow the drug industry to continue to make billions of dollars of profit off of us, right? The drug companies are subsidized by taxpayer programs like Medicare and Medicaid. And Medicare is prohibited from using its bulk purchasing power to negotiate lower prices with the drug industry. It was written into the law by a Republican Congress 2 decades ago in order to guarantee huge profits for the drug industry. I do not understand why there are a handful of House Democrats that are more interested in drug company profits than they are in saving the taxpayers' money, money that we will use to expand benefits for Medicare. We're going to use those savings in order to add dental benefits, vision benefits, and hearing benefits to Medicare. So I did a press conference on this in Connecticut today. I'm encouraging all of my constituents to get activated here, and I would hope that people all across the country are going to start calling into every single House Democrat's office and demanding that they stand up for seniors, healthcare consumers, instead of the drug industry.
Just to that point, a new study shows Big Pharma makes more profit than any other industry, strikingly so. The author of the study telling Newsweek, the pharmaceutical company's profits are really indistinguishable statistically from those of technology companies. The difference is that people need drugs to live, which of course underscores the exact point that you were making. So what then specifically needs to happen to rein in Big Pharma?
So you've got to give Medicare the power to use its huge purchasing power to negotiate directly with the drug companies. Right now, each individual insurance company negotiates prices with the drug industry. Walmart doesn't have each individual store negotiating the price it pays to buy goods that it puts on shelves. It uses its entire purchasing power of all of its retail establishments. The United States government should be negotiating on behalf of all Medicare beneficiaries. This would lower the price, and the result would be that the profits of the drug industry would get smaller. But while the drug industry, you know, makes up, I don't know, only 10 or 20% of overall Medicare spending, they're somewhere around 50% of the profit. So the drug industry can still make profit, even if Medicare is negotiating in bulk, but we can take those savings and use it to increase benefits for regular Americans. That's just a win for taxpayers, a win for seniors. And we've got to start putting the pressure on Democrats and Republicans in order to support something that the American people are absolutely behind.
Senator Chris Murphy, thank you so much for your time. Ahead, new bombshell revelations about Facebook, how Mark Zuckerberg ignored internal warnings about the divisive and hate-filled content swirling on the platform. Plus, Tucker Carlson, back at it, his massive new self-own on COVID safety measures. Stay with us. Now to yet another bombshell story on Facebook, revealing that Mark Zuckerberg disregarded internal warnings about divisive, hate-filled content swirling on the site, acting only after reports emerged that some Capitol rioters had used Facebook to organize, prompting a public outcry and forcing the company to review why outrage and sensational posts were running wild across users' pages. The Wall Street Journal reporting today on changes Facebook made in 2018, designed to encourage people to interact more with friends and family and spend less time passively consuming professionally produced content. Around that time, Zuckerberg was pledging to stop the spread of misinformation.
And there's a lot of hard work that we need to do to make it harder for nation states like Russia to do election interference, to make it so that trolls and other folks can't spread fake news. But we can get in front of this. And we have a responsibility to do this.
The Journal reporting that Facebook may have had noble intentions, but the changes backfired and actually made the angry voices louder. The company's own researchers finding that, quote, misinformation, toxicity, and violent content are prevalent. The Journal reporting that Zuckerberg knew Facebook was becoming a more contentious place, but refused to change it. In 2020, he rejected proposed fixes, saying he didn't want to pursue any change that reduced user engagement. The story is one of a series in the Journal called The Facebook Files. Earlier this week, we reported on another article from the files that Facebook's own research shows Instagram is toxic for teen girls. Joining me now, Keech Hagee, the Wall Street Journal reporter who wrote this story, and Rosalind Weissman, parenting expert, author of the New York Times bestselling book, Queen Bees and Wannabes, the basis for one of my favorite movies, Mean Girls. Keech, I'm going to start with you. You wrote this story. What surprised you most?
I was surprised, first of all, that they wrote some of this stuff down. And the most shocking thing was that there are some political parties in Europe who told Facebook that they actually changed their policy positions toward more negative and divisive ones so that that message would travel on Facebook.
Keech, you write that the company's own research showed political parties ramped up the outrage and sensationalism for clicks. Why didn't Facebook do more to change it?
Their own researchers were raising flags, but the reason was that there was a trade-off here. Mark Zuckerberg was warned about some of the worst things, and he said, you know, I'm willing to test it a little bit, but I'm not willing to do something broad if it means giving up engagement.
Rosalind, Facebook's own researchers point out that Instagram makes 1 in 3 teenage girls feel worse about their bodies. You know very well these platforms are the domain of women. We're a majority of Instagram users. I am a user of these platforms. I understand the comparative element, which exists in our lives offline as much as they do online. In addition to that, you have filters, you have retouch features. Those impact me, I will admit, as a grown woman. What is it doing to girls?
Well, it's making them feel terrible about themselves. And I really want to reframe this as sacrificing young people's dignity and their mental health. And we really have to get to a place where we have to realize the price that we are paying. And we are paying for it in young people's mental health. And when we continue to frame this in sort of other people's responsibility or Facebook thinking, you know, this is the domain of other governments or hiding this information, I'm just grateful that this information came to light because they've known about it. I've known about it in the work that I've done with countless young people who've said to me, Instagram makes me feel terrible, but I can't get off of it. I know know that it's curated. I know about all those filters. And yet when I see people on it, I feel terrible about myself. And so if we can really reframe this for everyone about these, this is taking away the dignity, the sense of worth that young people have about themselves. That is an incredibly high price that we are paying. And we need to really think about, you know, are we willing to continue paying this price? I don't think we should be.
Right. And Rosalind, to your point, there is definitely the role that we as consumers, as users, as parents or caretakers of consumers and users choose to make. That is sort of the immediate agency that we have. At the same time, these platforms are ubiquitous. I think many of us feel as though it is a professional liability not to be on these platforms. So how can Facebook change Instagram? If you're actually talking about changing the platform, what would it look like to create a platform that doesn't have this impact?
Well, I want to go back actually to what young women are feeling. And also the report, the article really also spoke substantially to boys also feeling this way. And we maybe to a lesser extent than girls, but I don't want to take away the importance of boys and their mental health, because so often that gets swept under. We don't think about that in the same way as girls. And we know that boys are suffering. So I just want us to think about this in terms of when Facebook in this article talks about, you know, look at researching or talking to young people, are we really actually having young people at the table? Because young people know that they are being manipulated, and they also know that they in some ways can't control it. Are we actually willing, and this is my answer to your question, is that are we willing to have young people at the table where they have a voice in being able to set parameters that really help all of us? And I would actually encourage all of us to look at young people as the subject matter experts of their lives, of being the recipients, of being targeted for their attention by Instagram, by all of the Instagram, by the influencers, by all of these things, that they are being told that this is who they should be. And that we, again, thinking about this in terms of their worth and dignity, and also focusing on that we are not teaching young people about how to manage their emotions and how they manage their social interactions with people, because oftentimes in schools we are curtailed or controlled to not be able to do that in ways that are open for young people, because we're so afraid to talk about what's really happening for young people. So if we bring young people to the table and truly ask them to contribute, I think we're going to get to a much better place.
Yeah, we can't ask them to teach us how to use the platforms and not consider them subject area experts. And I appreciate you, Rosalind, making this a more gender expansive conversation. Keech, I do want to ask you, 2016 election, Mark Zuckerberg infamously downplayed the effect of misinformation on Facebook. Take a listen.
I think the idea that fake news on Facebook, of which it's a very small amount of the content, influenced the election in any way, I think is a pretty crazy idea.
So, of course, Zuckerberg later apologized for those comments. But Keech, in your view, does he still have trouble admitting Facebook's problems? And when you look at these two seemingly very different questions in the aggregate, when you look at both misinformation and you look at the way that Instagram is impacting teens, what do you see as the through line, and what does it tell us about this company?
It tells us that while they are willing to study the problem, they don't have the political will within the company to fix them. That's basically it. They're incredibly talented people finding out really damning information and writing it down. But then when they would escalate it to Mark Zuckerberg, he wasn't willing to make the trade-off for engagement or for profits, ultimately, to fix the problems.
And that is where real change happens. Keech Hagee, Rosalind Weissman, thank you both. Ahead, news on the pandemic and the glaring hypocrisy coming from Fox, Tucker Carlson, plus AOC's Tax the Rich Dress, new reaction, exclusive. We are back with the COVID pandemic. We reported last night on how Fox News actually has a stricter vaccine mandate than the Biden plan. And the president took note.
Even at Fox News, they require it. And I'm not being facetious when I say that, but it's interesting that they've stepped forward and done that as well.
But the Fox misinformation continues. Last night, Tucker Carlson ignored the facts about his own employer so he could spread more lies about the mandates.
Joe Biden's order forcing 100 million Americans to take the COVID shot is totally insane as a matter of public health. This whole thing's a sham. It's all fake. It's not about public health. If you can force people to get the vaccine, what can't you do?
This matters because the Fox News base overlaps significantly with the millions of unvaccinated people who are most at risk right now. A study found that this summer, 59% of Fox vaccine segments included claims undercutting immunization. And at night, when Tucker's show airs, 92% of vaccine segments include negative or false claims. This misinformation has potentially deadly consequences. NBC reporting that COVID infections among children have exploded, with nearly 500,000 cases in just the last 2 weeks. Joining me now, Howard Dean, former DNC chair and former Vermont governor, and Dr. Natalie Azar, an MSNBC medical contributor. It is good to see you both. Governor, how dangerous is it for Fox News to spread false claims about the mandate?
Well, it's incredibly dangerous, and it's cost a lot of people their lives. There is a solution to this, which the Dominion voting machine people discovered, and Fox turned tail, is they should be sued. And they should be liable for the damages in the same way that Trump wanted Facebook and YouTube to be liable for the damages that they caused when they didn't screen misinformation off their sites. Fox News is killing people, and they can be sued for that. And you need a smart lawyer because they obviously have freedom of the media, the First Amendment, blah, blah, blah. But when the First Amendment is used to kill people, then you probably can sue them for a lot of money. And Dominion is probably successfully going to sue them. And I think some of the victims of these families could.
Dr. Azar, there is both the impact that it has on these people. There's the impact also that it has on health professionals who are having to intake these patients who have heard these false claims about COVID on TV or online. What is the position that it is putting medical practitioners in?
Well, Lisi, I mean, it's really just all part of our jobs. We, most of us spend at least part of every encounter inquiring of our patients their vaccination status, and those who are still, you know, reluctant or hesitant or have legitimate concerns about it. You know, we spend quite a considerable amount of time, you know, with our patients discussing this all. And, you know, I'm sure many of us also have, you know, friends and other people in our orbits who are getting their information, and in this case, a lot of disinformation and misinformation from these right-wing sites. And it's presents a challenge. And it does, I'll be honest, it gets exhausting after a while to, you know, have to fact check everything. But that's what we have to do. And, you know, I've certainly seen that if you do take the time and you ask people exactly what they are thinking and where they are getting their information, and you spend that time, you know, educating folks about it, they generally are more inclined to want to be vaccinated for their own safety and the safety of the people around them.
Which I was going to say is particularly relevant because study after study is showing that talking to your primary care provider is the best way to persuade someone who is otherwise unpersuadable on this. Dr. Azar, I do want to ask you, schools across the country dealing with COVID outbreaks, can you walk us through why so many kids are getting infected right now?
Yeah, Alicia, unfortunately, it's pretty straightforward. As transmissible as the Delta variant is to adults, it is to children as well. You know, we always talk about this concept of the R naught, how many people are infected by one infected person. In the original strain, it was about 2 to 4 people. And this one, it's about 6 to 7. So it's basically doubled the infectivity of the original strain, Alicia. And because kids are not, you know, under the age of 12 candidates for vaccination, they don't have that extra layer of protection that half of the eligible 12 to older adults in this country have. At least for the moment, although there are some, you know, we're looking very, very closely at the issue of whether or not COVID is more severe in children, the Delta variant. There's no evidence of that yet. It's just really a numbers game. The more adults who are infected naturally means the more children will be infected as well.
Governor, a perhaps unanswerable question, but do anti-vaxxers realize that they're putting their own kids and other people's kids at risk, too?
Well, there's a difference between anti-vaxxers and I think the kind of people Dr. Azar is talking about. Anti-vaxxers are basically nuts. And they have some kind of psychological problem with which prevents them from actually being rational. A lot of the people who are against the vaccine for all kinds of reasons, including political reasons, unfortunately, I think Dr. Azar is slightly not correct when she says the most effective way is is having them talk to their primary care people. Unfortunately, the most effective way is when somebody in their family dies of COVID. And we have seen story after story where people's last words are get vaccinated, or somebody loses their husband and leaves two small children behind. They say get vaccinated. Or some of the right-wing talk show hosts, there have been four of them so far that have died of COVID. That is a real waker-upper. And the truth is, the anti-vaxxers have always been there. They're a little off, but that's not a potent force. It's a more potent than it was because of Facebook and all that. The real potent force is people like Trump and politicians who are claiming that it doesn't matter. And unfortunately, they even trump medical advice sometimes.
Governor, I was the one who said that thing about primary care providers, so you're fact-checking me, not Dr.
Oh, okay,
Azar.
Sorry.
I also want to ask you, though, a New Hampshire Republican state lawmaker, also a doctor, so someone like you, both an elected official and a doctor, switched to the Democratic Party because of the GOP's policy. You saw that. What did you make of that?
I think it's great. I mean, there are decent people who are Republicans who see the light. I always talk about Governor Hutchinson in Arkansas, who signed a bill that banned mask mandates and then said he regretted it and it wasn't the right thing to do. Mike DeWine is a really conservative Republican governor in Ohio who's handled the whole crisis very, very well. I mean, just because you're a Republican or a conservative doesn't make you anti-vax. But there's tremendous pressure among Republicans to be anti-vax, to be anti-science. And if it costs lives, then people ought to find a different political party, because I think the Republican Party is morally bankrupt right about now.
Dr. Azar, I have about a minute left, but I do want to get you in on this, which is that Idaho hospitals so maxed out with COVID patients, they're contacting hospitals across the West so they can transfer patients. What kind of effect does that have on care in these areas?
Well, it's devastating, Alicia. I mean, for all the obvious reasons. I mean, even the level of care for the COVID-19 patients, could suffer if there's a shortage of important medications, tocilizumab, remdesivir, dexamethasone, not to mention all the other reasons that people seek, critical care, such as myocardial infarction and car accidents and things like that. There was even reports of hospitals closing because they didn't have enough staff to handle deliveries. And so there was no longer are going to be births at a hospital. I mean, it sounds crazy, but it is certainly something that we experienced, maybe not to that degree on the East Coast early on, but it happens. There's only so many hospital beds, and there's only so many ways that you can transform or reutilize the space in your hospital.
All while a vaccine is available that helps prevent hospitalization. Howard Dean, Dr. Natalie Azar, thank you both. Turning now to another important story. Tonight, new calls to punish or even prosecute the FBI agents who mishandled the sex abuse case involving more than 100 American gymnasts. Millions watch as Simone Biles, Ali Raisman, and Michaela Maroney testified about the abuse they suffered and the FBI's failure to act.
This is the largest case of sexual abuse in the history of American sport. It truly feels like the FBI turned a blind eye to us.
I can't tell you how horrifying it is to meet young girls who look up to me, who watched me compete in the Olympics, and tell me that they went to see Nassar because of me and my teammates.
What is the point of reporting abuse if our own FBI agents are going to take it upon themselves to bury that report in a drawer?
One of the journalists who broke the story says these young women had been telling their stories for years, but no one listened.
I didn't hear anything that was new that I had not heard before. They've been asking some of the same questions for a long time and have not gotten answers to those questions.
Today, one Washington Post columnist writing, quote, Larry Nassar is in jail. Why isn't everyone who ignored his crimes? The FBI just fired one of the agents who bungled the case, but his boss is now retired and collecting a taxpayer pension. He's also now represented by a lawyer who used to be the top DOJ official in the district where the abuse happened. So tonight, there is growing bipartisan pressure on the attorney general to consider charges against all the agents and prosecutors who allegedly let the abuse continue. others suggesting an independent special prosecutor to investigate. We are going to stay on this story. Ahead, AOC's Tax the Rich dress sparked a big political discussion. Exclusive new reaction next.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
A milestone in American politics. Colorado Governor Jared Polis and his longtime partner Marlon Reese got married yesterday. It is the first same-sex marriage of a sitting governor in U.S. history. Polis is also the first openly gay man to ever be elected governor. And finally tonight, a note on Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's statement at the Met Gala, wearing a dress with the words, "Tax the Rich," a theme President Biden hit today.
Where is it written that all the tax breaks in the American tax code go to corporations and the very top? I think it's enough. I'm tired of it.
The president echoing AOC's message. And I just caught up with the designer of that now iconic dress, Aurora James. Here is some of our exchange. What does it mean to you? What does it say to you that the president of the United States is currently sharing that message?
Well, you know, I think it's proof that you can't underestimate a woman in a dress, right? People want to say what they want to say about it, but ultimately it's about pushing the conversation forward. It's about, you know, putting the message on the medium. And I think that that's exactly what we did. And I think people are scared of that, to be frank. I think that people are scared of women of color. I think that we got extra slack because we are women of color. I think if it were a man to wear that garment, they'd be like, oh, you know, have a different point of view on it. And I think that people, again, like, they have these fears and they manifest itself in really dark ways sometimes. But ultimately, she continues to be who she is. And I think that she's set out to do, you know, exactly what she has done.
You can catch my full interview with Aurora James this Saturday on my show, American Voices, at 6 p.m. Eastern.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.